Hello and welcome back to The Good Shiz. My name is Kate, I'm your host, and this week, take four, an absolute epic with Tom Donald. I have known and I've worked with Tom for a number of years. We first met back in 2016. I had just quit my full-time job in recruitment, and I was on a mission to work in music. Fast forward almost a decade, we're still working together, and I think it's safe to say we've been through a hell of a lot. Tom's work as a musician is by no means a singular pursuit. A producer, musical director, coach, composer, film composer. When he's not being compared to giants like Jarrett, you might find him playing a concert at the top of the Shard, or jamming with the cenobium of monks in the Scottish Highlands. Tom is many things to many people. He's played such a huge part in changing my relationship with music over the years, and as the head of school and founder of the London Contemporary School of Piano, I've personally witnessed him changing the musical relationships of hundreds, if not thousands, of people all over the world. He has an insatiable appetite for life, for music, for business. I've very rarely, if ever, seen him having an off day. He's just a relentless problem solver, the kind of person who sees every mistake or failing as an opportunity to learn something. And for musicians like me, without leaders, risk takers, innovators like Tom, who knows where we'd be? But luckily, that's not the case. I can't wait for you to hear this episode. Here's my conversation with Tom Donald.
2, 3.
In progress.
Recording in progress.
I was going to send you a few question primers, but then I thought it might be more fun to
put me on the spot.
Just completely put you on the spot. Improvisation, something that you are very well versed at doing. So I just want the chat to sort of be as informal as possible,
and absolutely
just for it to sort of flow as much as possible. And I normally sort of start off with getting the guest to just talk a little bit about themselves and to give us a bit of background. I'm not going to do that with you just because we know each other very well.
Yeah.
I thought you might have some examples, or you might have thought about at some point in your life or your career, just like your earliest memories with music, and not even necessarily piano related yet. You know, you come from a musical family. Your dad plays guitar, so does Jesse. I know your mom played piano many years ago and does still today. But what did sort of music look like for you guys in the Donald household as a wee boy?
Yeah, I have very vivid memories of music as a kid. So firstly, there was the family piano. I mean, I probably would have been a guitarist if Mum didn't have that piano passed down to her, because in the music room, there was a piano. It's an old Australian brand called a Beale. It's a piano designed pretty much for the desert, which my mum grew up in the outback in Australia. So they had a Beale. It's a piano that literally never goes out of tune. It's got quite a brash tone to it. So it's a proper brash Aussie piano. And so that was the family piano. She got that piano. I mean, she was one of, six kids. So like...
Wowzers.
It could have gone to anyone else, right? But she got the piano. She must have done more practice than everyone else. Thank you, Mum. So she did her due diligence there and got the family piano. And so it was just there as a kid. I remember we were living in a place called Limbry, and my dad was the headmaster of a school with about 30 kids. So it's a very remote town. I think the town had no more than 50 people in it. And it was a primary school, and it just had one class primary school. And we lived next to the school. And there was the piano and dad's guitars. And yeah, I gravitated towards the piano. So had that piano not been there, I wouldn't have had a choice. It would have been guitar. And I just remember going up to the piano and just making sounds very unstrategically. I remember seeing dad's chord sheets, actually. I mean, this is literally, I was 4 years old.
Okay.
3, 4 years old when we lived there. And I saw his chord sheets to the songs he'd play, and I just look at them, and it was guitar tablature, and I used to just like guess what it meant, and I'd just play anything on the piano, and I'd sit there for hours, probably, or what felt like hours as a kid. But My other vivid musical memories as a kid were cassettes. I'm really very emotionally attached to cassettes, actually, because, you know, Dad would make a mixtape for car holiday, like when we'd on holidays and we'd sit in the car. And he'd often make mixtapes from his record collection. So I'm very attached to records for that reason. And he had a, you know, one of those, you know, late 70s style hi-fi systems where you record the record onto tape.
Wow.
Now, to me, that was like, wow, that's so cool. Putting a tape in a machine, pressing record and putting the record on, and it goes onto the tape, and then you listen to it in the car. To me, as a four-year-old, that was like, wow, it just blew my mind. Yeah. And the volume controls on there, I mean, the part of me I feel like could have been a sound engineer. I even still love looking at UV meters on machines and to this day. Like, it just, it's a real close thing to me. And rumor had it, because we, you know, in Australia is a really big, geographically a massive country, so we'd have to drive to places like Broken Hill and Adelaide, which is from the area of the New England area of Australia, which is closer to the coast. That would be like 2-day car trip. We'd stay somewhere, like drive for 10 hours, stay somewhere, and then drive another 10 hours. And I was apparently a very, very good traveler in the back seat as a kid. And people didn't fly planes in those days. It was, yeah, it was just not affordable and feasible. And apparently I was a really good traveler on the proviso that I chose the cassette.
Really?
But fortunately, the cassettes I chose, they weren't kids' music. I didn't listen to much kids' music. It was Billy Joel. I think my parents to this day are still sick of Billy Joel because I made them play Billy Joel's Greatest Hits 1 and 2 on repeat for 2 days. And if they turned it off and put something else on, I'd chuck a wobbly. So they're like, okay, keep the baby happy. Put on another tape. Keep the tape on. But I think to this day, they're like, oh, God, more Billy Joel. Can we listen to something else, please? So there's that connection to piano being forged.
I mean, it's their fault in a way because they would have played you Billy Joel at some point.
Yeah, well, Dad had the record of it.
Yeah.
And I remember the vinyl of it and of the Greatest Hits. It came out in 1985, that album, Billy Joel's Greatest Hits Volume 1 and 2. And it's a double record. And again, it blew me away that you could put a tape goes for 90 minutes and the double record goes for about 91 minutes. And it used to really bother me that at the end of side A, we'd lose about 10 seconds of the last song. And then I remember it was even when I was a little bit older, 5 years old, Dad said, you can get tapes that go for 120 minutes. And I was like, can we get them? Because then it won't run out. I mean, I was just obsessed. I mean, I a weird thing for a 4 or 5 year old to think about, but they were the things that really I was just thinking about. So, yeah, probably quite strange. And I remember actually even as a 5 year old trying to communicate this to other kids and them having absolutely no interest in what the hell I was talking about. And I really feel sorry for them, for me subjecting them to such weird topics.
I wonder what that is, because some people definitely have that and some people don't. It wasn't that early for me, but around the age of sort of 5 or 6, I remember being obsessed with a Counting Crows record that sort of is my record of sort of what has become like a hugely meaningful to me and my relationship with music, and has sort of come out in the wash over years and years as I've developed as well. And it somehow always comes back to that particular record. But I wonder what it is. I guess, you know, with your dad being a musician, you would have been listening to that sort of stuff as a youngster. It would have been around you. You would have sort of had the opportunity to latch onto it and to attach to it. And that's what I guess ultimately I put it down to. You know, it's the same with you and Yules and sort of what you play in the house around, yes, Lara.
Yes.
You know, it's music that you listen to, and ultimately she will then listen to. You know, you're not sort of reaching for the Teletubbies and the old McDonald's and that sort of stuff. You are encouraging her to sort of digest and listen to all sorts of music so that she can start sort of developing.
Yes. Seeing it through your own child is quite interesting because it brings back those memories yourself, and then there's certain albums she'll gravitate towards. I mean, she really likes Sgt. Pepper's by the Beatles, which is funny because my dad had that record.
Yeah.
And it didn't really connect with me. It's really cool. It's like, I think when you have that visual reference too, for a lot of kids, and it's just, there's just those albums are sitting around the house. There might be CDs, records, whatever, just a physical memento of the work.
Mm.
I think for a very young child, that can really attract them to the sound. It's like an opening into the music. I almost feel sorry for kids that are just now entirely digitalized. There are no physical references of the music in the house. It's just Bluetooth speakers and Spotify things, because I just don't think you can build that connection. Even when my 4-year-old takes over when we are using streaming, when she takes over the phone to change the track, she's not focused. She's not as focused as she is when it's a record or a CD. So I think it's quite interesting when you give a child just that space to listen and react and just let it sink in. I think, we often say that these things with music are related to talent only.
Mm.
But I've really had to rethink that over the years, because I think that's like a societal thing. We just tell ourselves, oh, that kid's talented. They've just got it, and some have it and some don't. But music is a language. I mean, it's the universal language, of course, but it is a language still. It has its own grammar and structures inside of it. And if a child is subjected from birth to parents speaking French, they're going to speak French.
Sure.
I mean, it's not because they're a talented French student. It's because that's what they hear. And I think if a child is subjected to music and the sounds of music and different types of music, it's going to make total sense to them when they're older. I think that's a big missing part of our education, is we're just talking about the formal education, but this informal connection in childhood is to whatever it is, whatever the subject is. I'm not necessarily just talking about music now. It could be any other subject. I think that this is a really, really important thing.
But that's so interesting about the physical, whether you're holding a record or you're holding a tape or you're holding a CD, because I'd never really, how we connect with music in our earliest years, it might be with an instrument, but not sort of in a very intentional way until you're a little bit older. So it would come down to tapes, it would come down to records, it would come down to, Lara, seeing how you take the vinyl out of the sleeve, how you put it on the deck, how you sort of lift the needle. And for my dad, it was the same. It wasn't record players, but he had a massive like oak CD player that I knew that I was only really allowed to go near when he was around. But as soon as I was old enough to be able to use it, and it had like a little drawer that you would pull out and put the CD on, and you put a magnet on top of the CD. It was quite a nice player. But sort of when I had license to do that, it was like someone giving me the keys. Do you know what I mean?
It's a little like a musical instrument. And perhaps that's why I liked cassettes as a kid, because, when you're 3 years old, you don't have much finger facility. So if I could record something onto a tape or make a mix tape or do something like that, it felt like I could have some feedback and interaction with the music, like playing a musical instrument. And even going as far as adjusting the settings and fading out the song and the thing that dub mixers all do, it is a way of interacting with the music without having to play a musical instrument, because a 3-year-old is not going to master piano, a 4-year-old is not. But you can really touch the recording in that sense with something like that physical product. And it's a bit like a toy in a sense. I mean, toys are serious things. Kids play with toys and they pick toys up. And a toy is not a digital thing. It's an analog thing. So I think that in my very early years, this is a long answer to your question. I think in my earliest years, I think it was that the physical recording of music that drew me into music. I would dare say slightly more than the piano. That was a foundation for me to start playing piano.
Yeah. there's an alchemy, and there's so much within music that is subjective that can't necessarily be defined and explained, but we are sort of working with constructs ultimately. We are working with concepts, we are working with a tuning system, we are working with
yes
tangible examples of how music is actually created. But for you personally, I don't know, maybe you've never even thought about it this way. But when you hear a record, and we'll take Billy Joel as another example, actually, because you've literally been listening to him for the last 40 years, you know.
Yes.
And he's just released some new music, I believe, which I haven't actually personally listened to.
Yes, he has, yeah.
But when you listen to the new Billy Joel record, for example, are there particular qualities that stand out to you more than others? For me, as a singer, it's always the vocals, it's always the lyrics, and I guess I can quite simply say that because I'm a singer. Obviously you're a keys player, but you're so much more than that, because that's not just, you could never define what you do musically by just being a piano player.
Yes.
So are there any particular qualities in a song that you listen to that jump out to you first and foremost, or that you look out for?
Yeah, I mean, consciously I'm trying to, you know, if one of my favorite artists that's close to my heart releases an album or a new work, I tend to be not so critical because I'm a fan, and I want to allow myself to be a fan, not a critic. Of course, if they release something horrible, I'll be disappointed and sad, but yeah. I would just be sad. I wouldn't be like taking to the, I wouldn't be shouting about it like people do. And as a fan, I think it's great to be a fan, because when you're a fan of an artist and your heart's in their music and you're rooting for them, you're not being a critic. Because I could get critical about anything to do with music, can't we all? Yeah. I mean, it's almost like it's easy to get critical about music and say, well, this could be better. That I think you could do it like that and that. You know, so I sort of avoid that paradigm if I'm a fan. And to me, being a fan is about that artist is like a soundtrack to your life. And that there are certain bands I've followed over the years, or artists that literally when they release a new work, I think of the last work they released before that, and what was I doing in my life then, and where was I going, and where was I listening to the album, and what and it feels like that every time they release something new, if it's of a quality where I'm enjoying and I'm still touched by it, they are literally the soundtrack to your life. So in Billy Joel, though, it's a bit different because he left so long before he did something else. I mean, his last record of songs, well, yeah, he did a classical record in the later 90s, so I do count that. But the last record he did before that was in 93. So that's quite a long time ago. I mean, we're sort of 20 years. On to particular qualities of the song. I mean, I just subconsciously, there'll always be chords. I mean, I just can't avoid it. To the point where maybe other musicians will say, Tom, is that all you think about is chords? Like this, there is more to a song than chords, you know, Tom. But to me, the harmony is the narrative. It's a personal thing to some extent. It's still a very practical thing. I teach this a lot, obviously, with the school and my education work, because chords are the entry point into piano music. Undoubtedly, is the reference point to get you started into piano, more effective than pretty much anything else I can think of. And you know, I've got years of evidence to show for that with students, but even when I hear these new songs come out from some of my favorite artists, yeah, of course, I'm subconsciously tracking that progression in my head. And because I've had years of doing that, usually if it's not a really, really complex song, I'll be able to go straight to a piano and play it and go, oh, he did that, had that little twist in it. And Billy's latest song is, it's got a beautiful progression to it. It's got a lovely flow of the melody over the progression. And the lyrics are very touching to me as well. It's not that I ignore lyrics, but lyrics to me need to be framed by chords. And I've noticed this accompanying singers for many years, that I tend to remember lyrics very, very well, but often better than vocalists can. And I think it's because of chords, because chords give an anchor point for me personally with the lyrics. So I'm associating lyrics and chords together, probably because I was learning to speak when I was learning about chords. So to me, the two are intrinsically linked, which is a sort of a bit strange. But another thing about my childhood is I was born with a hearing deficiency. Yeah. So the first 2 years of my life, my hearing was not, there wasn't much of it. So by the time I reach about two or three and the ear infections have stopped and my hearing is there, I'm feeling, I'm, and I had a speech impediment too,
because you can
when you miss those first 2 years of speech, I had to get speech therapy. I mean, the speech therapist said Tom may have a problem communicating for the rest of his life. Thank goodness that wasn't the case. And my father, very blessed, he works in special education, so I think he was sort of like, yeah, well, this can be fixed.
Yeah.
I remember going to speech therapy, and the speech therapist had to put her hand in my mouth to teach me how to curl my tongue to pronounce R. Otherwise, I would never be able to pronounce R.
Wow.
So that was going on, and I think by the time I was first really hearing and being touched by music, I was actually learning to speak. As I was learning about things like just hearing chords, hearing my dad strum chords on the guitar. So, yeah, I mean, the guitar was an important instrument because my dad would sit down and play guitar and we'd sing songs together.
Yeah.
And he'd play the songs that were on the records. And I'd figured out that somehow I knew in my head that the piano could do these chord things. I didn't know how to do them yet. My fingers couldn't physically play three notes at once. But I could see the piano was linked to all of that. So I think because chords are in my sort of mother tongue, I mean, I will hear a song, a new song from one of my favourite artists, and, yeah, of course, my head's in the chords. I can't escape that. even if I tried, it's inescapable to me.
I guess they are, as you say, they are the nuts and bolts and the foundation of everything, because if you don't have the chords, then ultimately you don't have anything or the platform to facilitate the vocals and the rest of the music.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of students will even say to me, because I do talk a lot about chords, like, oh, but you know, melody's important too, and they're absolutely right, melody's important, but just it's just so often the case in so many songs that the melody is housed by the chords.
Yeah.
Like the chords are the house, and the melody lives in that house, and that house is the space in which the melody can express itself. And just often in so many songs, that's just the reality. Even if the artist came up with the melody first, they need to house it.
Yeah.
It needs an enclosure.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's even a sum-zero game between the two. I think they are so incredibly complementary to each other. If I'm going to be a little overly technical, and you could literally say that harmony is the vertical construct of music and melody is the horizontal, the forward movement of time, whereas chords or harmony is a bunch of notes all played, you know, together at once. Though there's a horizontal relationship to that as well, because chord progressions, one chord moving to the next chord, to the next chord, and that from a purely technical viewpoint is what's happening in music.
Even the simplest progressions and you know, as we talk about a lot of the time, 90% of the music that we listen to in a popular context is the same few chords, the same bunch of chords. You know, we looked at that John Legend piece yesterday in the masterclass, and it's just sort of chords 1, 4, 5 mostly throughout. There is a bit of change as it goes into the midsection and things like that. But, you know, he adds the seventh and he starts the melody on the seventh, which is what Hope mentioned, which I hadn't considered before. And so,
yes,
you know, it creates a different... This is Ordinary People, John Legend.
Yes.
And it just sort of creates something very different. But actually all of his music... from a chordal perspective is simplistic, and the way that he sort of puts everything together is where the magic really happens. And obviously his vocals are amazing and the melodies are amazing and they're catchy and they're hooky. And
you don't need many chords either. You do not need many chords to make a beautiful song.
I find that fascinating, because you can so often be working with exactly the same things and get a completely different outcome. It doesn't necessarily have to be very complex chords, very complex extensions, very complex harmony to sort of get the same reactions. And that song, I'd never looked at that particular song, but I've always loved it. And I don't know why I hadn't ever considered looking at it, but it's just a sort of a prime example that some of the biggest and most beautiful songs in popular music often come down to the very simplest of chords and the very simplest of progressions, but there are other things that dictate the success of that song. You can define so much in music, but there's also so much that can't necessarily be defined.
Yes, yeah. I mean, if everything in music could be systemized and analyzed, I have this conversation with students who are like engineers all the time. They want to control music. They want it perfectly systemized. Now, if music could be systemized 100%, well, then anyone could write a great hit song. A song that's going to touch people. It's going to, I mean, there'd be a book on how to do it, and we'd all read the book, and everyone would be doing it. It doesn't work like that. We don't really know. There's that space in music which is there for analysis and understanding, and there's so much we can analyze, and there's a lot we know. We can know a huge amount of things. But there is that space that is purely, why is that song a song that people, is etched in people's consciousness, whatever the song might be? We'll never know why. I mean, get an album like Dark Side of the Moon. It could have, in a parallel universe that is pretty much exactly the same as our universe, it was a thing that was released by a band and no one really listened to it, and it was a sort of just a, if you've got any Pink Floyd fans listening to me, they'll be throwing things at their device right now. And it was like, oh, that was interesting. And it's got a couple of, fringe followers, and it's generally, it didn't get anywhere and the label dropped it. But, you just don't know why some, and there are a lot of records, by the way, that are just as good. On paper, they're just good. They might even be better. They might even be technically better. There might have been some concept bands around that we've never heard. So why that one? And that's where you can't analyze. Sometimes there's that magical feeling people get when they hear something. It's in the right place at the right time. I know that's a cliche. And people just latch onto it. And there's just no way of knowing why it was that song. On Elton's first great commercial record, his self-titled album in 1970, it was the opening chords of Your Song that sort of shot him up into chart success. But it could have been two or three other tracks on that album. Why was it that song?
Yeah.
You can analyze, thinking with hindsight, say, oh, it's because of this and that. But really, we have no idea.
Yeah. I was listening to a thing the other day. You know Jesse Harris, who co-wrote lot of Nora's first album? He cut a version of Don't Know Why.
It's a lovely version. I've heard it, actually.
I actually haven't. I meant to go and listen to it, but I haven't. But he was just saying that, he played that song to Nora and she liked it. And he didn't sort of know particularly why she latched onto that one, but she did. And obviously it's gone on to be one of the most successful songs that she's ever performed and sort of that he's ever written. I think he's sort of alluded to almost being able to retire from the royalties from that song.
Oh, yes, yeah.
But yeah, in his mind and as the writer, it wasn't something that he particularly placed all that much value in. But when Nora sang it and when that sort of that exact band put it together and it was recorded in that particular space, in that particular space of time, it changed the nature of that song and ultimately changed the trajectory of that song to something that he wouldn't have been able to achieve with his own version.
Yes. Yeah. I think if it's testament to anything, it's that artists should always be making chances for themselves by trying things. I'm not going to say taking risks. It could involve taking risks, but it could just involve writing a song and, if you had that feeling to write that song, or if you had that, I might just put that down or send that over to someone or do that. Knowing that the odds might be, not even thinking about the odds actually, just ignoring that. It's just, how do you know something's going to latch onto something? It's that, and again, there's no analysis that can say why it was that song.
Yeah.
Now we can, I mean, we could be lazy and talk about what's good about the song and, that's probably why, but that's sort of the hindsight. Like,
you can't write a song that way.
No, you can't. You can't. And people try and do it, and it never works, because it just can't be measured and systemized like that.
Yeah.
It's a great song. I can tell you why it's a great song, but that's sort of like, that's after the fact, so it doesn't count.
Exactly. Yeah. We can go away and analyze it till the cows come home. And
well, there's a, I know, it's Sunday, there'll be the Euro finals. Now, we can you know, we can talk about why one of the teams is going to win. It's England versus Spain. Either one of them's going to win, and people will be listening to this podcast after the event. And we can talk about why that team won and what the other team did wrong. And but no one says beforehand, that team's won, and that's the reason why they're going to win, unless you're a really good predictor of things. And
but even then, anything can happen.
Kane might get like that.
Kicked in the head in the first 15 minutes. And
right.
A dodgy ref call.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and no one knows what's going to happen. So you'd have to be a Notre Dameist to be able to sit with Jesse Harris as he wrote that song on that day, go, you know, that's going to really go somewhere, that piece. And if anything, we hear most of the time in music history are songs that were told they were going to go nowhere and defied the odds. Like, you know, that famous scene in the Queen film where they're playing Bohemian Rhapsody to the producers and the managers, and yeah, we can't share this rubbish on radio. No one's going to listen to this crap. And yeah, and it's that's, you know,
how do you know?
Rest is history. Yeah. I want to get into some questions about your writing and your composing, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, you've done such a diverse amount of work in your career, you know, whether it's recording monks in an abbey, recording with monks in an abbey, writing vocal parts for choirs, writing songs for choirs, you know, instrumentals, trios, improvisation concerts. You know, it's hard to sort of define Tom Donald the musician. You know, there's so much work that you do. So I'm just wondering, with your writing, firstly, can we expect to hear some music anytime soon, some more music anytime soon? And the second part of that question is, you know, when you sit down to write, or do you sit down to write, do you consciously carve out parts of your day, your week, your month, where you dedicate to your creativity, your writing, trying to conjure up something new? Is that something that you consciously build into your day, your work, your life, mm-hmm. or do you sort of wait for inspiration to arrive? Could you talk to me a bit about that?
Yes, I mean, my way of working is probably slightly too chaotic for most people. though I do carve out time consciously. That's definitely. I mean, I'm about to take a 2-week trip, and I'm going to the same place where I recorded about 2.5 hours of piano music, and I'm going to just go listen to it. And I haven't listened to it for a year, so I don't remember anything I've done. And there will be an album that will come out of that. So I've carved time aside to do that, because that's a big undertaking to go and listen to what I've recorded a year ago. And I've recorded it in a concert hall in Latvia exactly a year ago. And I'm going back there to now listen to the recordings.
Was that intentional?
What was that?
Was that intentional to go and record it and then to come back a year later?
I usually
to it?
Give it at least a couple of weeks, but not necessarily a year. But I didn't have anything to do with these recordings yet, because I released Pax Aeterna last year, which is the album with the Gregorian chant and the monks. And so there was really no space logistically to release something at the same time. So I knew all of these other recordings I have done that are sitting there, and these are just solo piano recordings, and there are certain concepts attached to them, and there's a certain album I have in my mind with it, but I knew that nothing could come out yet, because the Monks album had to be released late last year. That's been released, and now it's time for some new things. I just had Songs for the People come out, which is a song I wrote for the Citizens of the World Choir, which was sung by Ian Shaw. It's a song I'm really proud of, actually. It's probably the most joyful song I've ever written, and it's based on a beautiful lyric written by a 19th century African-American suffragette. But it's a beautiful, joyful song, a real humanity song, and the lyrics just sing at you. So that's just recently come out. It's under Citizens of the World Choir, and that's all available to listen to. So this new album that will probably come out of solo piano pieces is more of a classical album. So yeah, you were right to say my output's very diverse, which, you know, to anyone who works in the music industry, could that be considered very problematic, because you're meant, you know, you're meant to be pigeonholed, and the Spotify algorithm just doesn't know what to do with my music, because, you know, there's film music on there, there's jazz on there,
yeah.
There's solo piano improvisation, and there's classical stuff on there, and there's songwriting. So the algorithm's just like, oh, I don't know, I need something a little bit more categorized, thank you very much. But that's fine, and, you know, I accept that's who I am, and there is a thread behind it all. But yeah, this new record that will come out will be a set of piano preludes, very much inspired by Chopin and Bach, where I've improvised 24 preludes in every major and minor key. Wow. And I did it twice, and so I'll choose the best track to represent each key. That's my undertaking over the summer, to listen to all of them and structure it into this sort of larger compositional work. It's very classical sounding. The playing is very classical, maybe a sense of contemporary classical to it. You'll hear there'll be a lot of influences in it. And actually, I can't say much more about it because I don't remember everything I did.
What made you want to do that, though? Because you've mentioned having some ideas around concepts, and obviously Pax Aeterna was maybe we can get a little bit into the story about that. You've obviously an idea or source of inspiration, or something will sort of strike you and you'll go after it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always been very moved by great classical literature like the Bach Well-Tempered Clavier, where he explores his style of writing in every single major and minor key. And then Chopin and Shostakovich, the three composers that are very close to my heart. Shostakovich particularly. I mean, his preludes and fugues. He was influenced by Bach to do that, and writing in every single key. And the idea of creating a work that just goes around the entire circle of fifths. There's something really clean about it as well. When I say clean, it's a clean cut about it. And I think the marking of a classical composer, something about it, because it's an opportunity for them in a very slightly prescribed and narrow subset, like the first piece is in this key, the second piece then is in, moves to the minor, the third piece. You can choose what order the keys will go in. It's a composition, and they're short pieces. There's something about just within that limitation where the composer still has the opportunity to bring out something of their own. And that's what I love about classical music. The structure in classical music might seem on the outside a bit limiting. I'm going to write a piece in sonata form or a symphony in sonata form. But within that structure, it's just incredible how so many different personalities have been able to shine through. And sometimes when you have that structure, you're set free, particularly in the case of my way of working, which is a little bit, when I say chaotic, what I mean by that is that, yeah, I do set aside time to compose and to create, but I often come up with my best work when there's a sense that something's calling me.
Yeah.
And I don't know when that's going to happen. It happens enough, and it's happened quite regularly throughout my career, so I've been very lucky in that sense.
Sure.
And I do have times where there's not much coming out, and I'm just not in the space, and I just don't question it because I know it will happen. Sometimes it's a relief when I'm not there because it's like, oh, you know, I've got too much stuff right now that I need to go through and catalogue, and I could be doing that instead. And then I'll get the bug again and something will happen. So I don't know when I'm going to get the bug. And in a sense, I have that. It's a slightly romantic thing. You know, you get the inspiration hit and it just happens. Not every artist operates like that. Some artists can be very matter-of-fact and structured. And actually, when I've written music for film, I've had to be like that because it's going to a deadline and it's going to a brief that's not your own. And that's I don't mind working in that environment as well. In fact, the piece for the choir was an Arts Council commission. So, if I didn't get any inspiration, I would have had to bring in some craft and create something. Fortunately, I got some inspiration when I read that amazing poetry, I could write a song out of it quite quickly. But to me, it is a sense that there's a calling, something bigger than yourself, and you're like, okay, I've just got to plunge into it. And sometimes they're not very practical things, like with the monks, when they just felt like, okay, monks singing Gregorian chant. And I had this amazing project manager, a great friend of mine, Beck Donaldson, who'd been, she'd heard some of my improvisations on Gregorian chants I'd done on, you know, just as demos, and so we could find real monks, you know, it's possible. And then when she floated that idea, there was no way we could go back on that.
Yeah, so, and things slowly start to unravel and you start to sort of scratch the scratch card. And
yeah, that's it. And that was a painful process, because it took a long time to find monks, and then find monks that were willing to do it, and monks that sing in Latin and still do it the traditional old school way, and then monks were willing to let me bring a grand piano in there and then find a very amazing sound engineer to capture that.
And yeah,
some are more, you know, like writing a song can be much quicker than that, which though it can be just as equally painful when you get into post-production, as many songwriters know.
Totally.
Yeah. But yeah, it's I think one thing I perhaps I'm blessed with is that a lot of my music, because it's very improvised, does not require huge amounts of post-production. It requires organization and the ability to throw things out and not get attached to things, which I'm quite good at. I don't get too attached to things. I can hear something that I like 90% and just throw it in the bin and not share it with anyone. I'm very happy to do that, because I've got quite an excess of improvised music. You know, I have on my hard drive hours and hours of me improvising on my grand piano at home. None of it I've ever released. Maybe I will release some of it one day, but I don't need to get attached to things because I have that volume of work. If it's something more like a song, I tend to be the same. If I write a song, I quite happily keep it in the drawer or dispose of it. And I think probably another area is on some of the production side. I think I've seen this working in education, so maybe I'm blessed because I have helped a lot of other artists before and coached a lot of people. I think the micromanagement of one's own art generally, not all the time, but generally does not work very well. Now, it does work well if you're prepared to be, let's say, like a Beethoven. It's a very romantic concept to micromanage every aspect of your art. That means you do the production, that you do the mixing, that you have a say even in the mastering. You have a say in the every aspect of the record from beginning to end. Now, that is a little bit like Beethoven with his quilted pen writing a symphony. He has to understand how every instrument works in the orchestra. He has to have training in that. He has to write all the parts out, hear it in his head, go to the rehearsal, conduct it. That is what the romantic composer does. That's the romantic notion of a composer. And then when we went to the 20th century, music became more collaborative for so many different reasons. We had the jazz revolution, the rock revolution, recorded music, all of these changes, globalism. And, you know, I look at some of my favourite artists, like the Elton Johns and the Billy Joels. I mean, Elton's a great example. Goodbye, Yellow Brick Road. I mean, he wrote the songs in 2 weeks, recorded them in 2 weeks, all at a chateau in France.
Yeah.
And then just, once he did his bit, he just went away. He just got out of the room. He buggered off. Didn't have anything to do with it. That, I think, is the key to his success. He didn't get in there and say to Gus Dudgeon, the producer, you know, I would like the EQ on the drums to just be a bit lower that. He just got out of everyone's way. Of course, he had a very, very good producer.
Well, that's it. He's got the best team, yeah.
He had the best team. But that he put that trust in them. He just let them do their thing. And yeah, you obviously have to find that team and delegate and all of that sort of thing. But I think there's a huge that I think an artist has to make a decision in every project they do. Are they going to be Beethoven with the quilted pen, or are they going to be Elton that just walks out and studies, written the great songs, even has a lyricist, right? Writes the music, records it with the band, rehearses it with the band, records it, and he's out. And I think, I don't really think there's much middle ground. I've seen yeah. people try and swing between the two, and it's just painful to watch. Even with the quilted pen approach of being having a big say in all of the aspects of it, your knowledge and your skill set, it has to be so wide. You have to be like a Beethoven. That's what you've got on your shoulders. You have to understand every part of the process and have good technical knowledge on it. And then the question is that some people can do it. I've seen some people do it very, very well. But then the question is, you've got to ask yourself as an artist, you've got to know your limitations and your qualities. Are you just naturally good at some things and other things you're not naturally as good at? And should you just focus on the things you're naturally really good at? So if Elton can write a song in 5 minutes to some lyrics, rehearse it with the band, put it out, sing it beautifully on the record, but he's got, you know, he knows himself. That's why he's such a success, is it's that self-awareness. He knows he has no interest sitting on a chair watching guys play with the knobs.
that could have many connotations.
But yeah, maybe, he does.
Maybe. but he, you know,
I mean, that's, he knows he can't sit still.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's the, you know, he's got to go off and just, that's the energy of the person. He knows that energy. He's not going to try. And I've seen people of that profile try and do everything, and it's a disaster. If you tried to do everything, yeah, it's like, no, I've done my bit. And his bit's been pretty damn good as well, right?
Yeah.
You know, just write Yellow Brick Road in 2 weeks and sing it on the tape and record it and rehearse it with the band. Like yeah, you've done your job, man. You don't need to like. And so I think artists have to know themselves and have that self-awareness. It's a hard thing, self-awareness, because we want to do everything, we want to control everything, but that self-awareness.
Tell me about it. Yeah.
Of knowing what you're cut out for and what you're just not cut out for. Like, are you really a mastering engineer? Like, really?
Mm. Really? Do you want to go down that rabbit hole?
Yeah. Yeah, I can relate to lots of this stuff just with my record and sort of wanting to obsess over bass parts and guitar parts and...
Well, it's your baby,
you know. Yeah, but as you say, it's like, when do you go... When do you just let it go? I mean, as I said, there ultimately does need to come a time where you do let it go. And I did in the end. So I did eventually reach that point. But, you know, I think when you're working with a team of musicians, and I don't think I'm a controlling person, but maybe I am, because, you know, there were certain sounds and certain flavors that I wanted and that I could hear that I wanted to recreate what I'd sort of been hearing in my head. And so when you get some people in to help you recreate that, there needs to be an element of trying to illustrate what it is that you're hearing in your head so that you can try and recreate that. But ultimately it's going to come out how it comes out, because you're never going to be able to create exactly what's going on in your head.
Yes.
Because even just for me, trying to communicate those ideas is a whole other story, you know.
Yeah.
And if you can't communicate them properly, which is something that I'm sort of working quite hard on, I think it can be quite difficult to have that sort of musical conversation in an intellectual way. You go, oh, can you do a bit more or can you do a little bit more and it's,
yes,
you know, it's
yes. That, and that, this communication aspect, it's like you have to be a HR manager of your project. And that,
totally.
That actually is a skill. That is a skill that people have full-time jobs and get paid a lot of money for. And there's a reason for it, because it's an art to be able to communicate exactly what the project brief is, what is required of that thing, and get it across to other people. And I have to acknowledge one thing in this conversation, is we are in a different era now. We are in the era of more independent music than ever before. And I mean, independent music doing extremely well, where the artists are in the driving seat. We're not in the era where it's all label controlled.
Sure.
And the labels
were these massive conglomerates and people actually bought loads and loads of, you know, of the records.
Yeah.
So like the producers in those days, they were accountable to the label and that they had to produce very, very high quality work. So the Eltons of the world could just jack off after the recording session, because like, he could go away and just like, yeah, whatever, I don't need to be here. It's your job now.
Yeah.
You'll get in trouble with the big boss if you give something that's a bit substandard.
Well, exactly. He didn't have to push it over the line. It wasn't his responsibility.
And we are in the era now. So if you are having to delegate, that's a project management thing. And then it's... it's the ability then to, you know, you can bring someone in to do that, by the way. That's always an option. And if someone's never, if can't finish their work, and you don't want to be having to communicate to everybody things that are in your deepest imagination. The thing is, like, it's in your deepest imagination. How can someone hear that? And so then, you know, it's learning professional skills, like how to show a reference track and how to communicate ideas to a team and have a really good team that have that integrity, really care about your music. I think that's also the hard thing when it is run independently, because artists are working on their own budgets and you're working with busy people, busy producers and teams of people that have got 10 other projects going.
Yeah.
Getting them to give it that love and care and attention is very difficult, and that requires really delicate and well-crafted communication. It's not easy.
Yeah, totally. Because when you're an independent artist, you want to pay musicians for their time, for their work, for their contribution, for their creativity, for being able to be artistic with your work. But as you say, it can become such a blurry thing, because you also ultimately want them to really feel something for it, to really care about it. And yeah. I think it's quite a hard thing to juggle, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
Because we've all got to earn a living, we've all got to eat, we've all got to sort of be able to pay the bills and that sort of thing. And I'm sure that if we could all just make music all day and not have any of that stuff to worry about, it would be a different story. But
yes.
But yeah, it is quite a tricky thing to manage. I just wanted to talk, if you don't mind, about this. So we've talked about music and how you connect with it and how we connect with it, and ultimately chords and harmony and lyrics and sort of all these different qualities that can bring us to connecting with music in ways that can be explained but can't be explained. But a couple of weeks ago, you and I were at a gig at Brian's house at the jazz gig.
Yes, yeah.
And I had never really heard something like that before. And everyone in the audience loved it. And I don't think I'd get into trouble by saying anything about this, but I just really struggled to connect with it. And I seemed to be the only person that felt that way, because everyone else thought it was amazing. And I liked the tone of the sax. I thought there were some beautiful moments, but it was really hard and really jarring to listen to. And I could appreciate that the drummer was a good drummer. He was doing interesting things. It was interesting to watch, but there was nothing about what was going on that I could connect to in a way that a song travels, because I couldn't come back to anything that sounded familiar. There was no sort of repetition of an idea or a melody or anything. And so I just want to get your thoughts on that type of music, firstly, and then how do you go about appreciating something like that?
Yeah, so to frame the context of that,
we were listening to,
yeah,
from my understanding, well, actually, we were listening to improvised avant-garde improvisation. I guess you could call it avant-garde. I mean, I don't like to overuse that term because it applies to a wide range of things, but it was improvised music that did not have a pre-planned or structure to it that was preset. And so, yeah, if you're – I mean, there's a few things I would say. Is like there's talk about being open-minded all the time. Like when we're meant to love everything we hear, I mean, that's like – I just think that's just not entirely intellectually honest, because there's things that resonate with us more than others. There are jazz pianists that resonate with me far more than others. It's not because the other ones are not no good. It's just that it just doesn't resonate with me. Their harmonic language, their style of playing, their way of their modus operandi. I just don't feel as much. And it's entirely a personal thing. And then there are things where that don't resonate immediately, but later you can form an appreciation for if the time and the place is right. So I have my own example of that. This is in classical music. I really only liked tonal classical music up until the turn of the 20th century. And not even like the neoclassical stuff, which is a little, it's still tonal, but a little more, there's, it's just got a completely different harmonic language. And I love the Tchaikovskys and the Rachmaninoffs. So I was like obsessed by it. But the sort of the Soviet Russian composers like Prokofiev, Shostakovich, at first when I was 10, 11 when I first heard that stuff, completely left me cold. I felt nothing. I even tried to like it because I was like, oh, I want to listen to more of this beautiful Russian classical music. But this Prokofiev, I remember the first time I heard his amazing third piano concerto, I didn't connect with it at all. It just felt like noise to me. And so why didn't I like it? Well, in hindsight, I can say a lot of things. I just was listening out for the things that I loved in Rachmaninoff's music, in Prokofiev's music, and you're not going to get that. It's like going to an Indian restaurant and expecting a Sunday roast. It's just, you're not going to get it. So if you're listening out for structure in improvised music, you're going to be left starving. You're not going to get any of that. In some improvised music, there is structure. If you're listening out for a verse that's going to connect to a bridge to a chorus, you're going to get nothing out of it. So then, and this happens often when people listen to music from other cultures as well. Like, you know, if you put on Indian raga music, you know, a 30-minute raga, to the Western ear, they're just without the harmony in there and the chords, because it's not music that's built on chords and harmony like Western music. It's built on modes and scales going in this melodic narrative for quite a long period of time, enhanced by rhythm with tabla players and sitar players. And I remember the first time I heard that, I was completely lost. I was like, what's going on here? Where are the chords? Where are the chords? I remember saying, actually, it was a musicologist who played it to me. And I was a teenager, and I remember it was like at a music class where we had sort of a touring musicologist go to different schools and play different types of, you know, music. And I said to him, where, like an arrogant 15-year-old, I said, where are the chords? And he goes, that's like saying, where's your underwear? But so, yeah, that's the first thing why – that is the technical reason why one will not connect with something, is if you're looking for something that's simply not there, you will be left unsatisfied. So if you really want to enjoy something and you're just not enjoying it, the first thing you're not going to enjoy it straight away, because if you've been listening out for certain things in songs your whole life or pieces of music, it's going to be there. It's like when I was talking about the chords with Billy Joel, you know, like, yeah, it's going to be there in your back of your head, just like you want to be listening out to these things. But then when you say, okay, that none of that's there, what should I be listening out for to enjoy this? If that's the goal, to enjoy it.
Or appreciate it.
Yeah. And I think with avant-garde music, I remember when I first ever heard a piece by Stockhausen called Contact, which, you know, one of our teachers at school, Suwan, played. But I heard it at college played. And, all the composition students were told we had to go watch this amazing piece by Stockhausen. And I did not enjoy the concert at all. I was like, it's just pretentious. I just didn't like it. And again, I was listening out for all these things that weren't there.
Mm.
And then I noticed, it's quite interestingly, I noticed, and this is where I learned so much from that experience. I went to the concert, listened to the work. It's about 45 minutes. I think I liked about 20 seconds of it. There was a bit where
no one
was playing anything.
during a rest.
No, there's a bit where the tambourine syncs up with the piano and they do this really weird rhythm. At the same time, I was like, well, that's pretty nifty. How did they – they're not just making this up. This is clearly all written down. Wow. You know, like, that was the only bit I enjoyed. There was just one section. It just surprised me. But I didn't really feel anything. There was none of that emotional connection that I get when I listen to a Mahler symphony of depth and emotion. It just felt like just an intellectual, you know, whatever. But it just didn't connect with me. And then I remember this was at college, so I go out. It's nighttime and I go to the bus stop, and, you know, this is in Australia, so buses come every 45 minutes, you know. I'm just waiting, sitting in my busy road and cars are going by. It felt like I was listening to the music still, and I was listening to the timbres of the cars and the sound of the tyres and what are the notes of that.
And I realized this Stockhausen has just made me listen to everything as if it's music. And see, avant-garde music, often like that, is about the color of the sound. It's not about the notes or the chords or the melody. Those things are of not of importance. They've moved aside and replaced with ideas like color of sound. How can instruments imitate the sounds in life, the sounds of a road, of traffic, or of nature, that is not in a sort of scalic, musical, familiar territory. It's in another territory. And so perhaps if one is to go into listening to music like that, knowing that that's what the expectation is, yeah, these musicians are exploring sounds and trying to create sounds. They're not trying to create melodies or chord progressions.
Sure.
That is not existent. That has now been taken out completely. And the reasons for the composers of that avant-garde period in the mid-century, their reasons were, we can't do anything else with melody and chords. It's all been done. I want to do something new. That was their desire to innovate, which I deeply respect. Doesn't mean that everything they came up with I really like, or it doesn't mean that when I go home after a long day I want to listen to it. But I think when you frame it, the expectation, that can enhance one's appreciation for it. When it's music from a non-Western culture, I think it's a little easier to appreciate because you just know it's a different culture. It's not innovation. Indian classical music is not about the innovation. It's actually tradition. It's just that their tradition and values in music are expressed differently to the way it's done in Western. And when you actually look at some of the way they explain things in improvisation, it actually makes more sense than the way we explain it. It's less academic. They give scales and modes people's names, and then if there's a relative mode, they give it, like, that's the sister of,
right, you know, like your sister's name, you know, that's right, Kate, yeah, and that's Angela, and that's Paul, and that's, and they've got, yeah, all these names, and it's a really quite beautiful and artistic in that sense.
And then that's like a little door you can walk through to appreciate the music a bit more, but you are dealing with a different sound world, and it could take quite some listening and a long time to feel emotion that you would feel with your favorite bands and songs. It might never even happen. It might just be a matter that you only get to the appreciation level. And again, I really want to emphasize what, go back to what I said earliest, is that we don't have to love everything,
yeah,
that we hear. We are allowed to be human beings, I believe, and have our preferences, because in our preferences, our strengths are there, our priorities are there, and those things are really important. But yeah, of course, if we are in a position where we are listening to music that is less familiar to us, I think the checklist is try and avoid listening out to the things that you would normally listen out for, because you'll just be disappointed. It's like going to a film. I guess it's a bit like going to see a sci-fi film and getting a romance. You know,
yeah,
you're there for the sci-fi, but you get romance, and you're like, well, you're going to be left feeling like you've been starved. I won't do or vice versa.
Yeah, but that's such a good way of putting it, though, because as you say, if you can go into something with a better frame of the expectation and how to appreciate it, then you're going to be better equipped when you're listening to it, because I desperately wanted to connect with it in some way. I didn't know how to. And so in that moment, it was incredibly difficult. And it sort of left me feeling, you know, very curious about what had just happened. But yeah, it's, as I said, it's, I think this is the difference between what you know, what you're used to, what have sort of been your staples musically in life. Obviously, our backgrounds, we love a lot of the same music, but your background could never be compared to mine in the way that you've explored all different types of music. And so, you know, there's an understanding and a knowledge of that type of music that I just sort of haven't even tried to uncover yet.
The thing also with this particular big gig we were at, it was all completely improvised. And because I am an improviser in a lot of my own music, even though I don't necessarily improvise in that style, I can feel that they're improvising in the sense that I'm sort of wondering, there's a curiosity, like, well, how are they going to react to that when that happens? You sort of, when every time I hear someone improvising, I'm putting myself in their shoes. I can't help it. I'm like, well, what would I do in that situation? Oh, I would have done that. That was where my instincts would have gone. But he chose to do that. And that's sort of,
I guess that informs the next step from each musician.
That's what's keeping me on my toes. Yeah. It's not even the music. It's more so the decision, trying to feel and read their decision making and me wondering what I would do myself in that decision making.
So that might have been when I was at the gig, my head was just like staring in, like really taking it in. And you were wondering, what's Tom listening out for?
I'm so confused.
You're like, what's going on here? Which is totally understandable.
I have listened to things where I felt completely cold, like not just that experience as a kid with Prokofiev, even music from other cultures. And when I hear African music, my heart music, traditional folk music from different African states in history, like that moves me because it's so attached to American music. It's so attached to just the musical narrative of that we've heard our whole lives. We don't even know. So there's like a sense of returning to roots. But for instance, when I've heard things like Chinese opera for the first time and a lot of the Japanese folk music with singing, I really struggle to feel moved by the tone of the voice. And I almost feel ashamed because they're like, my ears are so westernized and I'm finding these sounds just not, I'm not enjoying this. Yeah. And I want to enjoy it. But of course, it's no different to listening to a foreign language and you just don't know what is being said. And it's totally okay and understandable.
Sure.
The question is then, if you feel inclined to want to understand more about it, then you've got to go in and learn some of that language. It's not, and that might be understanding the history behind the music or the message behind the music or what people are moved by with the music, reading a bit about it, just listening to very small amounts of it in your routine. I think there's a lot of value in doing that because I think it's a bit like traveling, I guess. It's when you see the world and different parts of the world you didn't know about, your perspective changes. When you go back to your home looks different because you've got something to frame it. And the time I've spent in the Middle East studying Middle Eastern music because I've written films, music for Middle Eastern films, that really changed the way I listened and heard things.
Sure.
It was really challenging sometimes because there were some things in that musical culture that I'm very drawn to, the minor scales. Like I feel emotion in that. So I guess there were some opening doors for me. If it was Chinese opera I was trying to get into, that would have been much harder because the doors, I couldn't find the doors. But sure, there are ways to find the doors if I apply myself to that. But
if you were so inclined to.
If I was inclined to, yeah. Exactly.
And actually, there's a lot of great Australian composers that were very influenced by East Asian music, and they've done some incredible things with it. So there are doors there. And perhaps if I were to get more involved in that music, I would study some of that Australian music that investigated it. There was a whole movement of Australian composers in the 60s that wanted to redefine Australian music as being an Asian construct rather than a British European construct. And so, yeah, that's really fascinating as well.
Yeah.
But these are conceptual things. But I would just say the first thing is that if we hear something that doesn't connect to us, just the question we ask ourselves is, what am I listening out for? Because it's not there in the music, probably, and that's why I'm not getting an experience that I want to get.
I have one or two more, but I'm conscious of your time and your day, so I don't want to interrupt anything else.
We're going full Joe Rogan style, you know.
Okay.
Deep dive.
Do you have, okay.
I do have about 15 minutes, if that's
okay.
All right.
Yeah, then we'll just do one more. I was just curious, if I could give you a scenario. Say, for example, I gave you a call right now, or pretend we're on the phone, and I said, Union Chapel's just called. It's going to be a full house tonight, and there's a beautiful Blüthner concert grand that's just been tuned, all ready for you to play. You don't have to worry about the audience. You don't have to worry about the instrument. Would you take the opportunity, or when you prepare for gigs and performances, would you want more time to really think about what you're going to play and what you're going to do?
Do I get full say over what I'm going to play?
Yeah.
I'm there.
It's your gig.
oh, you can give me an hour's notice. I just have to get there and get my clothes on. Yeah, obviously, I don't want to show up in my housewear, so
sure.
I need time to, if I've got enough time to get my clothes on and get myself to that venue, you can give me as little notice as possible. And I've got no plans that night that are that I can't wriggle out of. That, though, that again, that's, I feel like I've been preparing for that my whole life. So,
that's what I was getting to. Music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like that edginess. If I was told I had to play a particular classical work, well then I would have to learn the piece.
Sure.
That's different. But yeah, if it's my own gig, yeah, it's the show's ready whenever it's ready. I just have to click the play button. They're often the better gigs, I hate to say as well, for me, because
you don't have that much time to think about it.
Yeah, you can overthink something that's been in the diary for a long time, and you shouldn't actually. I'd sort of let it creep up on me a little bit. If I know what the type of show it's going to be, I played a concert at Spencer House, a very stately venue, late last year, and I didn't really think about it too much. I knew it was quite a formal occasion, but I didn't overthink the repertoire, and then probably thought about some of the things I was going to play a couple of days before. It was probably one of the best concerts I've given in a very, very long time.
Yeah.
Because just the emotion of the audience, I could really feel it, and I just played off them, really. But I wouldn't have known that was there. They could have been a really dead, uninteresting audience.
Sure.
They could have just been coughing all their way through. It's the middle of winter. They could have been coughing and, you know, feeling restless, but they just happen to be a magical audience. So they, all these unknown factors that you can't control, that are simply not in your control.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't really be. You have to be a control freak to some degree. You've got to know you've got a good instrument and your rider's list and all that stuff. But there are some things that will never be in your control. They're just and
sure,
that's part of the sport.
Yeah,
and I find that attractive. Actually, I do enjoy that. I'm not a daredevil. You know, I'm not an extreme sport person. I don't like winter sports and skiing off the hills.
Yeah, I hate that.
You're not
going to
go
stuff.
Parasailing no, in Switzerland.
Not into that stuff at all. Yeah. But I'm into that stuff when it comes to music.
Sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's where I'm a daredevil. I like challenges. I like risks. I enjoy taking risks. I love it. Actually, I get a buzz from it. It's a drug to me. I just do it with music, nothing else.
What about? I would highly doubt that there is a day that goes by where you don't touch your piano, unless you're traveling or you're not in an environment where there is a piano. But I was just wondering if you have a particular ritual or a particular part of your day that you play something just for yourself that's not got anything to do with your work or what you're doing for the school or anything like that, just for you and just for yourself. And I was wondering what that is.
Well, yeah, if I'm doing things with students or with the school, I'm playing what I play for that. And a lot of that is practice what you preach, because it's principles I abide by myself. Though, obviously, they have to be adapted to the individual student that I might be working with, and that they're in a very different position to me, so it's not entirely the same either. So when it comes entirely for my own music, I really am very driven by my own intuition with this. I don't overstructure my practice. Sometimes I keep a bit of a log of what I'm doing to keep track of it.
Sure.
Like I did this today. I'll forget I've done that, so I'll just make a note that I did it, so I'll go back to it. So I have to take notes often just to remind myself that I was doing some good things with that. But no, there's a broader thing that really shapes my practice, and it's, to me, practice is, it's me trying to dig deeper into my musical consciousness and demonstrate a deeper understanding of what is somewhat going on. And the more, and it's one of those things, the more you know what's going on, the less you really know. But that, to me, is what practice is. It's not a bunch of technical exercises. It's not a bunch of drills. Occasionally, I will have certain drills I do. But really, the essence of all playing and practice to me is there a, is getting, can I find, can I deepen my understanding of the expression of what I'm doing. That really is all it is. There's not much else to it in that sense.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've watched you play for many years now, and...
Yeah, you must be so sick of hearing me play.
No, not at all. Not at all. But I think, you know, with music, and we've talked about this a little bit with songwriting in the episode that I did for the school, and sort of breaking...
Yes. Yeah.
Breaking the conscious mind.
Yes.
And just existing with you physically touching the instrument and connecting the instrument and not necessarily thinking about what you're doing, but being sort of led by the purest part of yourself.
Yes.
I think being able to access that is an incredible thing. And as you say, the more you practice, the more able to do it you are. And as someone who improvises a lot, I think
yes.
that's the sort of the best way to be able to do that. But I often hear musicians, singers, songwriters talk about their music or a particular song or a particular time on stage where it wasn't them. They talk about not being themselves. They talk about being like acting through the music and almost embodying something completely different to their conscious minds.
Yes. Yeah, I think your conscious mind can over-control things
yeah.
and make limitations. I mean, it's a difficult thing to talk about because it is, in my teaching, I've seen how everyone just has different ways of learning, and I've trained myself in education in how to teach people who operate on different ways. Some people do need very conscious planning to achieve anything. That's just the way they are, and that's totally fine. Some musicians are like that. I can hear it in certain musicians that they've really built something from a very structured place. I can hear it in Brahms or Bill Evans. They have a very different modus operandi to what I do, and that's what I admire about them. And I can see it in certain students of mine where if I'm talking too much subconscious thinking with them, it just leaves them cold and they don't quite understand how to... They can understand the concept, but they don't have a way of relating with that. Mm. So as an educator, I obviously... I try and not put my modus operandi onto other people. I would never let that happen. But for myself, if I over-consciously think of everything I'm doing... I start to feel trapped. I'm on that level of the spectrum. I trust the structure will just emerge somehow, and it usually does. Though having said that, I could be missing out on opportunities by not being a little more regimented and structured. But I'm quite happy to make that trade-off to let that thing happen that I had no idea was going to happen. Chase that going back to the just letting your instincts go with the extreme sport of it, and just like, okay, you've just got the gig, you're going to play this, you're going to mash this up, you're going to that interaction with music is still so attractive to me that
yeah,
if I have to make some trade-offs to allow that to happen, and I'm still preparing for that to happen, I'm practicing and rehearsing that over in my head all the time.
Sure.
What would happen if I had to play this piece like that, or if I added that to it? What would happen if I got that scale from Indian music and I put it into a jazz piece? I'm always asking myself those questions, so
but I'm you always can, preparing you, for it.
But you can imagine it in a way that is almost completely realistic because you've built such a catalogue of memories and experiences musically that you can almost download straight away, right? Because but or to download some sort of form of that.
Yes.
You know, you can play something in your head, I'm sure, as if you were physically playing it, and it would sound
it's
almost exactly the same because you're so practiced in it.
Yeah, when you've been speaking the language your whole life, I guess that helps so much. But it's also, I think it's the ability... Like if you're going to grab something from here and something from there and put it together and mix it together and and just download it straight away, as you said, you have to be prepared to really simplify a complex idea and then flesh it out again.
Mm.
So you've got to get an idea that's complex and go, it could be a style of music, like play something in the style of this composer, or as a creative template to create something new. I do it in some of my concerts. So someone said the last Shard one I did, I play Messiaen in Stevie Wonder in the style of Messiaen.
Wow. Yeah.
And I, you know, to do something like that instantly off the cuff and create something fun and new and interesting, you have to stereotype the composer. So Messiaen, okay, big chord clusters. So that's like I'm explaining a composer with a very sophisticated, wonderful musical language that's rich and steeped in culture. You know, I've just turned him into a meme in my head. It's sort of, it's not very kind, right? And I've Stevie Wonder, I'm like, I'm going to get that little bit of superstition, which is all on the black keys. Again, I've done the same thing. I'm generalizing Stevie Wonder down to a meme.
Yeah.
And then that gives me the headspace to do something quickly to make that download. So the download is not – so, yeah, it's people going, my gosh, how's he doing this all on the fly? He's just downloading that. Wow. And it's like, well, this is a download of only 1 megabyte. It's not very big data. I'm downloading tiny things. And then it's like a zip file, right? I've compressed it. I've overly compressed it. And then when I go to improvise and make something out of it, I'm expanding it out again. Then I'm trying to grow it out and make it.
And it gives
to unzip it.
Breathe sophistication and complexity and beauty and all of the nice things into it and the culture back into it. So so someone says play something in the style of Mozart. Well, you know, I just get a little lick he always does and put a melody over the top. I've just basically generalized Mozart down to that. Again, it's not really nice, isn't it? There's much more to Mozart than that.
Sure.
But it's a starting point. It's a reference, and then I can go further with it and build it out and grow it out back again. So it's download a very tiny bit of information and then go to town with it, really open it back up again.
Yeah.
And it's a process that's definitely not everyone's cut out for, because I teach a lot of people, and the idea of simplifying complicated information, particularly for those who are more, let's say, engineer head thinking, scientific thinking, it's not very comfortable for them to do that. And I understand it isn't. I mean, I wouldn't want someone who's landed an airplane to think like that. I wouldn't want a surgeon to think like that. If a surgeon thinks like that, I wouldn't want him operating on me. And so I can respect that that's not the modus operandi, even for some musicians. It's certainly... But that would be the modus operandi of doing the sort of off-the-cuff stuff, because you just don't have time to put too much thought into it.
Yeah, and that's, as you say, that's the stuff that really sort of fires you up. It sort of really lights you up.
Well, I like the sport of it.
To be living on the edge like that. Yeah,
I like the sport of it.
Yeah.
You can't be too much of a perfectionist when you do stuff like that too, because you're going to stumble. Things aren't always going to go right.
Sure. Thanks so much, T. I've taken up quite a huge chunk of your time, and maybe
it's
we'll do
a pleasure.
Maybe we'll do a part two at some stage.
Pleasure to be on the program.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'd love to come back and chat more. We should do it.
Yeah, I'd love that.
So many good topics.
I mean, it doesn't take us much to natter on about music for hours, does it? But
no.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time to sort of talk through the questions with me and just to talk more about yourself and your relationship with music. And I think so many people are fascinated by that, but we don't really get much opportunity to sort of dig into you, Tom, as the musician. And I know people are going to love hearing this. So, yeah, I really appreciate that.
Absolute pleasure, Kate. Thanks for having me on the program.
Yeah, you're welcome. We'll talk soon.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. There is plenty, plenty, plenty more to come. So if you're new to the show, make sure you subscribe. You can find us in all the usual places, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, etc. On socials, at The Good Shiz ZZZ, as well as via our website, www.thegoodshiz.com. thegoodshiz.com. We'll see you next time.